This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends, to a special edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. Today is International Transgender Day of Visibility, and I'm Benjamin Norris, and I have been exploring the stories of Australia's LGBTI influencers. Each week, we've been sitting down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guest is a prolific member of the non-binary trans community. Their story wakes people up and inspires all generations to question their thoughts and feelings on the transgender community. Assigned female at birth, from an early age, there was something different about their childhood, as dressing as a boy and acting like a boy became a common way of life. During their young adult life, they came out as a lesbian, but then they questioned their gender identity and came out as trans. You may have seen their story on the ABC on a program 1 Plus 1, and by that stage they'd already appeared in a documentary about gay teens called Love in Full Colour. Their story was also featured in a teacher's guide produced by the Safe School Coalition Australia. They are an activist, an educator, a writer, a poet, and they are the author of the memoir Finding Nevo. I would like to welcome you, and I would like to welcome Nevo Zissin.
Transgender activist Nevo Zissin.
Discovering your transgender, it's a lot more complicated than anything else.
But I'm going to tell you that I am transgender. Like, it doesn't matter whether I'm trans or not. Like, please laugh.
I don't think that we want to think about those things. I think we are very selective with our history. As long as we're all asking ourselves that all the time. Like, are you acting out of love or are you acting out of ego? I think when we ask ourselves those questions, we can really create community spaces that are abundant in their love and unconditional in their support.
Nevo Zissin. Yep. I'm going to keep practicing that.
You have done your research.
Well, yeah, I've become mildly obsessed with you, which I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
I think that's what's interesting about your story in general is that I think when people dip their toe in the water and start finding out about you, it becomes addictive. Because I think all people want to know the truth. I think all people want to get on board with the trans community and learn more about it and do the right thing by the trans community, which your story helps a lot of people be educated. Do you feel like that?
Yeah, definitely.
I wonder throughout today's interview if we could do something, which is you're helping me out. Now, I can sometimes believe that I'm a bit stupid, and that's probably why I get some of the pronouns wrong. But I also don't want to rely on that as being an excuse. Like, I don't think that's a good excuse, but I do think it would be good of you to correct me throughout this, because I think other people who are listening, they should get on board and learn how to say things properly as well.
Yeah.
Is that a weird thing to say?
No, I mean, I will correct people anyway, whether they tell me that it's okay or not, if they're going to get my pronouns wrong.
How do they react to that? Like, when you quickly jump in there and correct people, are they apologetic?
Yes, sometimes too apologetic. Like, I've actually found sometimes people will be like, I mean, less about they pronouns and more, you know, when I first transitioned and people would be like, she, oh my God, sorry, I meant he. You know, like, whenever you're around, I always get it right and I don't know why I just stuffed up then and I'm really sorry. And it gets to the point where it's like so over dramatized that you actually have to comfort them. And that's when it's an issue.
I hate that.
Yeah, it was the worst. So all you have to do is just like politely correct yourself and move on. It's not really that big a deal. Like, we all make slips in our language. Like, that's just how language and humaning works.
So I guess it's human nature.
It is human nature to make mistakes. Just like, don't make that big a deal about it. And don't get defensive if someone corrects you.
I'm going to give you a huge apology at the start because I certainly don't want to be offending you. And I also think it's so exciting to be talking to you on this particular day. Growing up, did you ever think you'd become this prolific?
Oh, it's such a hard question to answer because I'm not sure if I would use that word for myself.
No one feels comfortable with that, but let me try and explain this to you. I think that you have a certain amount of notoriety amongst certain circles.
Yeah,
I think
because fame is like a really weird thing. It's really just a projection from other people of what they think it is or what they really want, which could be money or power or whatever, and you might have neither, but they might still see you as famous.
How would you describe your story so far?
I would say that I'm confusing. I mean, the subheading of my book is how I confused everyone. So that is very much what I, like, pride myself in. You know, I've had people read my book that were like, wow, I really, really related to a lot of that. And not trans people. I mean, my grandma said that to me. And I was like, whoa, okay. Like, I think that we can all relate to feeling insecure in our bodies. We can all relate to issues of bullying and social isolation. We can all relate to growing up, how uncomfortable puberty can be, how like our body shifting and changing is like surprising, family issues, identity crises. Like, I think those are all very human issues. I don't think that they are just applicable to trans people or to LGBTIQA people.
Well, we're definitely going to get into that a little bit later, but sort of looking at the origins of you, Zissin, which is your surname, where's that name? What's the heritage of that?
So my family is Israeli originally. Well, Eastern European, Polish, French, Russian. And yeah, it comes from there.
Growing up in Australia, you would have faced a lot of the same obstacles that I guess a lot of Australians had. But what part of Australia did you grow up?
Caulfield in the Bagel Belt.
In Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it like growing up there?
In some ways incredible, in some ways stifling. It's really nourishing and nurturing and judgmental and tight-knit and sometimes suffocating.
Such a lovely place to grow up. You know, it can sound like a bit of a minefield in some ways.
Yeah.
What were you like as a child?
I knew that I was a boy or that I like felt like a boy from the age of four.
Wow.
I was like really set on that. Like my mom tried to force me into dresses as a young kid and I just would cry. I would like have tantrums in the girl section of Target and would just like not allow that at all. I would like desperately try to like have my hair cut as short as possible. I only wanted clothes with like dragons and skulls and that kind of stuff. Like
that hasn't changed.
It's changed a little bit. Anything like frilly and pink, I was like, nah, I'm not doing it. Yeah, I was just very assertive. I've always been very assertive. I've never been hesitant about who I am or what I want.
And what was your relationship like with your parents growing up?
My mum really struggled with me identifying as a boy and wanting to be a boy. She was so desperate for a girl, which I find really funny because I think like the politically correct answer when you ask someone if they want a boy or a girl is like, I just want a happy, healthy baby. But she was like, no, I want a girl. So I often joke with her that it's her fault that I ended up doing trans. So she was desperate for a girl, and to her that meant certain things, right? Like, it's not just like, oh, I'm desperate to have a child with a vagina. Like, that's not really what people are thinking when they want to have a girl. It means that they want femininity, that they want a certain life, that they want her to get married and have kids and be the mother and be the wife. And, you know, like there's a lot of roles that comes with that. It's not just as simple as like, oh, I just really want a girl. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's so true.
It's a very specific thing.
It's a very gender specific thing. I mean, it's gender with roles specific thing.
Yeah, exactly. So my mom was really set on all of that stuff. So when it was quite obvious that I was never going to be that girl. And I think this applies to like anyone who is like a bit gender bending or like, or just exists outside of your parents' expectations. Like, I think I describe parents as like a GPS system, and I think they have like a set destination for their children. And if you take a wrong turn, it like takes them some time to reroute.
Do you know what? That's so funny. Cause I remember going on Chapel Street with my mum and I was like, I'd need to go into MAC. No, it was Kit Cosmetics at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, what have you got to go in there for? And I was like, I've got to buy my makeup. I've run out of things.
Yeah.
And she was like, what? You wear makeup? And you could see from the transition of being, a lack of a better word, being inside the makeup store to start with was uncomfortable. But by the end, we both bought makeup and walked out.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay, well, things are a little bit different.
Yeah.
That's the reroute.
Yeah.
You're
and
right.
It's like, oh, okay, I can still get my head around this. Like, but sometimes they lose connection and that rerouting takes a really long time.
Is that how you would describe your father?
No, that's how I would describe my mum when I first came out as trans. And then I would say the GPS exploded, which is something that I advocate for in the very beginning. I think that like having a child with a set destination is just like bound to be terrible. Like, for example, when kids come out as gay and then you're like, oh no, you're not going to have children. The assumption that your child was going to have a child anyway is such an assumption. Like, there are so many straight people who don't want to have children that just, like, don't want that, you know? And, like, would you really want them to have a child if they don't want to? like just for your own ego or your own family lineage or, you know, so I think like those kind of things are quite dangerous in general. And I think they lead to like parents being disappointed with their kids, kids being disappointed with their parents, kids worrying that they can't live their own lives and that they can't be self-determined or that they can't be autonomous. So I very much like describe parents like that.
So you looping your dad into that, or was the, your story with your dad different?
My story with my dad was different. So my mum, yeah, really struggled. My dad kind of thought it was funny. He was sort of chill with me being a little boy. Like we would go to the supermarket. I remember once and an old woman came up and was like, oh, what a beautiful little... And he was like, girl. And I was like, no, boy. And then she just like slowly backed away. It's just very uncomfortable. But yeah, he was into it. He was cool. We had a very like father-son kind of relationship. My dad and I had like a lot of different issues throughout our relationship. Like I have nothing to do with him anymore. It wasn't necessarily related to gender stuff though. So like he was like...
So you can't put that blame on it. It's not like you're saying, no. Okay, the destruction of that relationship was because of you transitioning
it
or...
It was because of him being... terrible.
And you had siblings as well, so like how many siblings did you have?
So I have two brothers and a sister on my dad's side, so they're all half and they're all at least 10 years older than me.
Yeah, right.
But I'm very close with them and their children, and yeah, we have a really great relationship.
What have they been like through your transitioning?
Difficult. Really, really, really difficult. It's interesting now because, you know, like I'm standing at a point of retrospective. Like it's I'm standing on this like pedestal above everything that's happened. Like right now my relationship with them is great and we've worked through a lot of things, and my book was a big part of helping work through that stuff because I think seeing the story reflected to them really helped them get some perspective on it, like to actually see it in my words, which was interesting because it wasn't something they were able to hear from me directly. They had to actually read it. And so that made a big difference. But yeah, initially it was an absolute nightmare. Like my sister was a lot better than my brothers. She was a lot more medical about it because she came from a medical background. She would ask me questions like, okay, well, what now? What does testosterone do? What are the pros and cons? What are the effects? What are the long-term effects? And those were all questions with like finite answers and like with actual answers that I was able to provide. So having that conversation with her was quite empowering because I had done my research. I could answer that. Whereas my brothers would ask me questions that were very like vague and philosophical, like, how do you know this won't change? What does it actually mean to be a man? Why can't you just be a butch lesbian? Like, you're going to end up looking like a freak. And if you don't have a penis, you won't be a man. And, you know, things like that, that it was like, I don't know how to respond to this because I actually don't know the answers.
Well, I guess it says an evolution for you as much as anything.
Exactly.
How are you supposed to have those pressures put on you?
And I don't think that trans people are allowed to have that gray area, that we're allowed to make mistakes or are allowed to change our minds or we're allowed, you know, like I think so many decisions in our life are big decisions and we don't realize. Like I think even choosing the soup over the salad at that lunch one time could have totally changed the direction of your life and you just wouldn't know that.
The sliding doors soup.
Exactly. The sliding doors. Like exactly. So I think there's so much pressure put on trans people to be 100% certain. I mean, I remember when I went to my chest surgeon right before chest surgery and he said to me like, this is it. This is like a permanent decision and there's no going back from this. Like once you get your breasts removed, that's it.
Did you perceive that as a lie then?
Yeah, I was like, that's bullshit. Like, I can't get my breasts back. But if I really wanted in like 5, 10, whatever years, and I was like, oh, I really want breasts, I could get breasts again. Like I could get surgery and I could get breasts again, or I could buy breastplates, or I could do what drag queens do, or, you know, like there are so many different options. And like, I feel like as trans people, we're not offered the space to make mistakes or to change our mind or, you know.
And who's to say what's happening in your journey is anyone else's business?
Well, exactly.
You know, people need to learn how to say less, I think. Oh, for definitely. Me, I think sometimes I struggle with my own sexuality and sometimes in the sense that I don't always fit the homo mold. And so I think that's a lot about my own journey. Like there's lots of homosexual people out there that don't wear makeup like I do. Yep. But I'm sure that probably people that are surrounded by me probably think that I'm like all gay people, where everyone's story is different. And there's probably thousands, probably millions of diverse types of sexuality.
Yeah, and I think that there are like 7 billion
or you go 7 billion
genders. Like I definitely think that for each person there is a different gender expression and a different like incarnation of sexuality.
What role did you play in your family? Like, did you have a role that you played amongst your siblings and your parents?
I definitely played the baby. Like, I was the youngest. My family was kind of tense because it was like, you know, my dad and his ex-wife had divorced and he had these three children. And then my mom came in and kind of like semi-parented them, and they were like in different custody arrangements. And and then I came along. And so my mom and I sort of were like the other family in a way. And then my siblings and my dad were like sort of on the other end. And then when my parents got a divorce, which was like really bitter and really horrific, I was kind of just like the one alien in the family a little bit, because like my mom was out of the picture in that sphere. So it was like me, my dad, and all my siblings, who like all kind of, it felt like, came from the same side and were all similar ages, like, as in, obviously not my dad, but you know, my siblings are all just a few years between each other, whereas there's this huge like 10-year gap and more between my siblings and myself. So
how did you unite that relationship? I mean, how did you maintain it?
It was really difficult. Like, all the family holidays were done by the time I was born. Like, that it had already kind of been done, you know, the whole like raising children was sort of done. Like, my dad had had a vasectomy before I was born. He wasn't planning on having any more children, but when he met my mom, she was desperate for a child, and so they actually went through IVF for me.
Wow.
So I was very much like a lone soldier. Like, I was very good at entertaining myself and looking after myself. I was very independent as a child.
You're a wanted child.
Yeah. So when kids in kindergarten would make fun and be like, "You were a mistake," I'd be like, "Actually, no, I was 5 years in the making. So nice try."
I guess it's a strange question to ask, but what age were you when you started to work out your sexuality? And when I say this, it's a journey. So, like, totally. I believe that there's different levels of this. But when you started to realize that your sexuality was different to others.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think that's the thing about difference. Hey, it's like kids don't know that they're different until someone points it out to them. So I definitely think like my first thoughts on sexuality and stuff were probably when I was quite young. But I wouldn't have known that that was different. Like, I had a huge crush on like Kim Possible. Like, from the cartoon. I was really into her, and I really wanted her and the, like, villain girl to get together. I did not realize that that was queer. I didn't know that was, like, gay. Like, you know, I
cartoon sex is hot.
Yeah. I wouldn't have had any indication of that. When I was, like, consciously aware that my gender, like, that my sexuality was different from others was probably around year eight. I like started questioning my sexuality. I had a huge thing for Pink, but I thought that was like really standard because she's a babe. And everyone in high school and like in that year kind of had like a person they'd go gay for. That was kind of a thing. It was like, oh yeah, I'd go gay for Beyonce, or I'd go gay for Angelina Jolie or whatever. And so I was like, yeah, sweet, I'll go gay for Pink. I just didn't realize that I didn't have to go anywhere.
But then did you find that yourself linking into people that you were lusting after all, or being drawn to, were more commonly women?
Well, it wasn't really that that kind of indicated it. It was more because I really thought I was like into boys. Like, I was like into the like make out culture that was happening at that time of like going out to parties and trying to kiss boys. And I had a boyfriend in year seven and whatever. Like, I was into it. But then I started to have a crush on a girl my own age. And that was when I was like, okay, maybe there's something more here. So I just thought I was bisexual, and I just kind of like repressed that for a little while. And it wasn't until year nine, when I shaved all my hair off for World's Greatest Shave, that rumors started that I was a lesbian, because as you know, like the length of your hair dictates who you're attracted to, not
clearly
who you're attracted to. So I loved that, because I was like, yes, I love breaking stereotypes. I'm going to be this like hot, straight woman with a bald head and who's all about the earrings and is like breaking stereotypes. And then I realized I was gay. I was like, damn.
And how old was that when you then realized that you're gay and then you were having a relationship? Because that was quite young, wasn't it?
I think I was like 14.
So 14, you're having your first relationship. And how long did that last for?
Well, that wasn't with the girl that I had a crush on. It ended up being with, so like my school was a part of the Safe Schools Coalition, and we had our own like queer group that would meet once every 2 weeks. And I went as a straight supporter, or that's what I told my mum. And I met a girl through there who was like the head of the group. And then we started a very tumultuous, toxic relationship for a little bit.
So you don't speak to her anymore?
Definitely not.
How long did you go out for?
It wasn't even really going out. It was like very on and off, like just playing with heartstrings and, you know, your first real heartbreak. That's what that was.
And then how did you then come out as a lesbian? Because then obviously you realised that amongst yourself, and then you obviously approached your parents to tell them.
Well, not exactly. This person was like very dominant and like controlling, and had actually left like really big hickeys on my neck, of which my mum discovered. And I tried to keep it hidden, but like wearing a scarf in summer is a bit of a giveaway. I even put like band-aids over them and told her it was like mosquito bites that I'd scratched too hard. Like, she did believe me, but then one day she caught me without the scarf on, and her first question was it from a girl? So she obviously like had her suspicions, and she had said to me growing up, if you turn out to be a lesbian, I won't be surprised, because when I was a child, I presented as a boy. So that was kind of like a resounding thing. And my sister even said to me like, oh yeah, like if you're attracted to women, that's cool. Just like, don't be attracted to me. And I was like, do I have to explain to you the difference between gay and incest? Like, what is it, the 50s? Like, what is going on?
That seems like a really uneducated thing to say, but I mean,
it was.
That says more probably about her naivety.
Definitely.
You know,
it doesn't say anything about me. I was never.
I'm like, that's a little weird.
Yeah, definitely. I was freaked out by that.
But then what did you say when you came out as gay, or as your mum might have passed that information across to your father? Like,
so my mum didn't, because they were divorced and they were not speaking.
Right.
So I kind of like, yeah, came out to my mum as bisexual. She held on to the hope that it was just a phase and that I would like go for men again. She really didn't know how to police my sleepovers, because she just thought everyone was a threat. I had to explain to her that I was 14 and that it was fine. And then, so with my dad, I was able to kind of get a bit more time there and come out when I was more ready to. With mum, there wasn't that option. So with dad, we were away. We were overseas in Vietnam having dinner. And I think, I don't know, I guess I just like wanted to tell him. And so I was just like, blah, 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 gay issues, blah, 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 the media and gays, blah, 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 gay, gay, gay. And then he was like,
are you gay?
Do you have something you want to tell me? And I was like, yeah, look, I'm gay. Yeah. And so he was kind of like, in his thick Israeli accent, like, you know, I don't mind if you're a lesbian, just like if you want to have your girlfriend over, I just don't want to see you kissing. But same thing if it was a boy. And so like, he was really cool. But his brother is queer. Like, his brother had come out as gay years ago and like is now in a relationship with a woman and identifies as bisexual. So like, he had some exposure and awareness of these issues. But then he came out on my behalf to my siblings, which was
that's like annoying.
A huge breach of trust. It's not just annoying. It's like not okay. Like, it's never okay to out someone.
Then what was the journey to your realization that your identity didn't fit exactly right and that you decided to transition?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting because so often do we hear stories of trans people and then we just assume that there was a light bulb moment, where in actual fact, it's not.
It's never like that. But it's never really like that with sexuality either. I don't feel like we ever really have light bulb moments of clarity that it's like, oh yeah, this is the answer. You know, like, I don't think we exist in a world like that. I think we want to. I think we really want to have like black and white everything. But that's just not, like, I exist in a grey cloud my entire life, and I always will. Like, the
it
same way
that,
like...
It seems like that, if you look back at time, though, like, you know, for me, when I look back at myself, I think it's not exactly like I got a letter in the mail, you're a homosexual. Like, as in, it was obviously gradual, but when I think back, because we rewrite history in a way,
totally,
in our own minds, it kind of does feel like if someone asked me, when did I come out? I'm like, I was 14, and all of a sudden, this happened. You know, so it's easily confused.
It's easy when you, yeah, when you have the retrospective. But I think, like, if I had a conversation with myself at that age or at different ages in my life, like, they would have different things to say, you know, and that's important.
Did people come to you and realize that you might have been trans before you worked it out for yourself?
Yeah.
Is that frustrating? Or was that hard to deal with?
It was hard to deal with.
And who was that person that approached you?
It was my girlfriend. I was in a relationship for 3 years throughout high school, in a monogamous relationship with another girl who I'd met through like minus 18 and that whole scene. And we had a very passionate, tumultuous, first love kind of dramatic relationship.
That's what happens.
That's what happens. And she would make little comments like, oh, you're like definitely trans, or like, you're such a guy sometimes, or whatever. And I'd just like laugh it off. And honestly, like, you know, even though I was a lesbian, I didn't really know what trans issues were. I didn't really know what trans people were. I didn't really have any trans friends. My only like media representations were like Jerry Springer, like, having two trans women, like, rip each other's wigs off. Like, it wasn't exactly, like, healthy or accurate or, you know. And then anything else was just tragic. Like, and I think the queer community has grown up with that for a long time of, like, our media representations are just tragic and there's death and there's sexual assault and there's murder and, that, you know, like, it's just awful. So I didn't really have much insight into what that was. I just thought I was a very masculine lesbian.
So you went and did the research then for yourself and then discovered it?
Well, I started feeling some discomfort in my body. I mean, I'd felt uncomfortable in my body most of my life, but I thought that it was related to my weight. Like, I thought that I was like a skinny person trapped in a chubby person's body. And then when I started to lose weight and I still felt that way, I was like, maybe this is something more. And I mean, I would look in the mirror and I would, like, I would stand in front of the mirror naked and I would be like, okay, my face makes sense. Like, my face makes sense to me, but nothing else does. Like, I just don't feel connected to anything else here. And I thought that was just normal. Because again, you don't really know that something's different until someone tells you otherwise. So I think being in a relationship with another woman was really, really kind of empowering and powerful because women don't really talk about their insecurities in their bodies so much. They're not really given that platform. They're not allowed to feel that way. And so to be with another woman and for her to explain to me, like, that's not how I feel about my body. Like, that's not what I see when I look in the mirror, kind of made me realize, oh, okay, maybe there's something deeper here.
And then at that stage, do you, I don't know whether or not because of the being actively involved in a younger queer community, did you know what processes to go through? But do you go to your GP or, like, what's the process where you start to think about wanting to look into that medically, I guess?
Well, for me, first I went through, like, a really deep, really bad depression in discovering that. Like, it wasn't like a, now I get it. Like, it was terrible. I went into, like, a deep, dark pit, and so I couldn't really climb out of that for a while. But I turned to social media first. Like, I think Tumblr was a huge support for me in that time because I was able to connect with trans people from all around the world and just do some research and do some reading and just be like, oof, yeah, okay, that really resonates with me. And, like, yep, that's how I felt. And it just made me feel seen. And I wasn't really ready to take on the, like, medical side of things just yet. Like, it was more the psychological I needed to come to peace with it within myself first. So I did that first. And then, yeah, I guess I spoke to, I just, like, posted in Facebook groups and I just spoke to older trans people and I got in touch with people and I had mentors that kind of helped me through. And yeah, you, like, go to a GP. I mean, it's different for everyone. And also, like, not all trans people go through a medical process or whatever. Like, this process looks different for everyone. But what my process looked like and what it was in Australia is that, like, I called the gender dysphoria clinic in Monash and was like, I need to go and see a psych and talk about this. They were like, cool, there's a waiting list of, like, a year. I was like, that's not going to work for me. Like, I'm deeply depressed and, like, really on the edge. And I mean, I'm doing year 12 this year. Like, I don't have a year.
It's already,
like,
a very mucky time for a teenager.
Exactly. And I was already dealing with anxiety and depression because of my parents' divorce and because of just everything. Like, there was just a lot going on. So to put gender in that mix, it was, like, a really dangerous cocktail. And so I was lucky enough that I came from a relatively financially stable background. So I was actually able to, like, bypass the waiting list and just pay for the appointments instead of getting them.
Which meant that you were obviously getting support from your parents.
My mom, yeah.
She was actively wanting to financially support you through...
No. No one was actively wanting to support me.
You were making it happen.
Yeah.
I guess the hardest thing that people don't understand is that it's a journey for yourself as much as then you having to defend it. Because you were then having to say, this is uncomfortable for me to work it out.
Yeah.
But then it's also a part of your job to then convince medics and your mum and people that this is what you want to do.
I mean, you're fighting yourself, which in and of itself is so hard. And then you're fighting literally everyone else. And not just fighting, but also educating. Like, I was educating my teachers, I was educating my principal, I was educating my girlfriend, my friends, my family, like, everyone. And I was exhausted and I was miserable and I didn't even know what to educate about because I'd only just started learning about trans things. Like, just because you're trans doesn't mean you know anything about transness. I think that, honestly, I think we saw that with, like, Caitlyn Jenner when she first came out. Like, she was such a baby trans, you know, and she even said that. She was like, I don't really know what I'm doing. Like, I'm just, like, starting to discover this about myself, you know, like... in trans years, she was a few months old. Like, you know, so that's where I was at. I was a few months old and people are asking this like newborn baby, like, can you explain everything to me? And I'm just like, gaga goo goo, I don't know what's going on.
And then you guess your mum would then have like, is there like a grieving process for parents with their kids having gender reassignment? Do they then grieve the loss of their daughter or their son?
I definitely think they do. I think that's when the GPS dies, because I don't think that they're really grieving who you actually are. I think they're grieving what they wanted you to be.
Which is so weird that people have that belief of who their children are going to be before they're born, or hold on to out-of-date traditions,
yeah,
you know,
because
or ideals.
Because I would say to my mum, like, are you actually mourning your daughter? Like, did you ever really have one in the way that you like wanted one? Like, am I different? You know, like, and I ask her that now because, like, you know, it's been a few years now and she's sort of settled into things more and we have a much better relationship now. But I say to her, like, am I different? Really?
Was I really anything different to this, Mum?
Like, yeah. I mean, I've always been the same person. Like, I've always been exactly the same. And she describes it as same person, different package. She said, you're just a lot hairier now. Like, that's really, and I've just got a lower voice. But really, like, I'm the same person. I have the same core values. I have the same love in my heart. I have the same gentleness. Like, I am who I am, you know, that hasn't changed.
When you were younger, you obviously had, insert, landmines of obstacles to get over with your journey, being diagnosed, as you said, with depression and having anxiety. Would you say that in some way, that that's your body's way of pushing you to where you needed to be? Like, do you think that that's a part of the process? It's your body's way of saying to you that you are different and you need to do something?
No, I would say that was society. I think society makes us anxious and depressed and miserable about who we are. I think if we had a society that told little boys that they could wear dresses and that they could play with whatever they wanted and that's fine, and that little girls could do the same, I think if we had a society that just like was a society of abundance and didn't push us into boxes that we don't fit in, then I don't think I would have felt that way. I think if I lived in a world that I like just stood up and was like, hey, I'm a boy, and people were like, cool, and then the next year I was like, actually, I'm a girl, and they were like, cool. And then, you know, I was free to just like experiment and be who I wanted and for no one to tell me it's just a phase, because you know what, like everything is a phase and that doesn't mean that it's not relevant or that it's not valid when it exists. It just means that we're like evolving, growing human beings, and maybe that's like a really positive, amazing thing. I don't think I would have had the mental illness battles that I've had. And that's the important thing to note, is that like trans people and LGBTIQA people aren't mentally unwell because of their gender or because of their sexuality. They're mentally unwell because of the way that people treat us.
Very true. And you realize that that is the relationship between the suicide rate and sexuality.
Yep.
Is not because we are not strong, but it is because we have been treated a certain way for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's not because we're innately mentally unwell. That's a very old school kind of like early psychologist way of looking at things.
What I think is interesting is that while you were growing up, seeing as that you were brought up as a girl, what insights do you have on the differences in the way that society treats gender?
Yeah, I love that question, because I definitely debate feminism with people often, because I am a very strong unapologetic feminist and men in particular find that threatening and don't agree. And I love to be able to use that to say I've actually lived in society as a woman and a man. I know the tangible differences. Like, you can't really argue with that. Like, that is just like a perspective that a lot of people don't have. So, well, some of them, for example, like a lot of the words that people use with you shift dramatically. Like, when you're a woman, people call you darling, sweetheart, honey, love, which I find creates quite a bit of a power dynamic, of sort of lowering and patronizing you. Whereas once I transitioned, I was like, mate, bro, man, dude. I'd walk into a 7-Eleven and I was suddenly like best friends with the dude behind the counter. Like, he'd be like, hey, bro, how's it going? I'm like, oh, this is cool. Like, I'm part of this like covenant that I didn't even know I was going to be part of. Like, that's interesting.
But it's highlighting the fact that men probably get treated still in this day and age, which seems ridiculous, better than women.
Oh, definitely. And like, yeah, it was weird because it was like I was given this gift of like male privilege that I never really wanted or asked for, but I was looking at it through like a feminist lens. So I was like privileging and benefiting from it, but also deeply disgusted by it. And it made me feel really uncomfortable because I'd spent my life as a feminist against like the patriarchy and male privilege. To then receive it myself was like, ew, like I don't want this.
But even as a strange thing, you were talking about in a particular interview that I saw that you had to change your behavior in some way. Like you were walking down the street at nighttime and you noticed that there was a woman that felt uncomfortable because you were a man walking behind them. So there's those sorts of things as well, which is weird.
Totally. It's like so confronting. Or even like entering feminist spaces and talking on my experiences of misogyny and people being like, who are you? You're just some dude. Like, you're just some like man. You don't know this. And it's like, no, actually, like, I have a complex history and like I've grown up as, you know, I've been socialized or treated in society as a woman. Like, I have a different story and you just don't know that or you don't see that. And so, yeah, I mean, I definitely experienced people listening to me more, not interrupting me as much, laughing at my jokes more.
Wow, that's so weird.
Yeah, and I can command an audience easier. Like, as a public speaker, I definitely think I'm afforded a lot of privilege in presenting as a man.
If you had the opportunity of being able to speak to you as a 12-year-old, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, actually, the very end of my book, the last chapter, or the afterword, actually, is a party scene in which I go to a party with myself at all different ages. So there's me at about 4, there's me at 12, there's me at 17.
And I love it.
It's literally that question. It's like the conversations that we have and the things that we say. And, you know, I've got like the 4-year-old running up to me and showing me this new skull ring that he's got and he's really excited about it. And he's wearing a dress that he's like been put into for the occasion. And so I say to him like, hey, you know, like you can take off the dress. Like it's just us. And he like lights up and gets so excited, takes off the dress and is wearing like a dragon t-shirt or something. And he's like, I'm a boy. And I'm like, yeah, I know. He like gives me a hug and then like runs back into the room in a way that he wouldn't have been able to if he was still wearing the dress.
There's something so deeply emotional about hearing that.
It was like a really emotional, really cathartic experience writing that, especially after having written the whole book.
So what is that in a sentence? Like if you could just right now have that sentence.
I guess I would say like, it's all okay. You don't have to have all of the answers and no one has more answers about you than you do.
Do you think that childhood leaves a scar in a particular way on you as an adult?
Yes, I think it does for everyone. I think that's where our deepest traumas come from. It's like the first time that we were ever hurt, the first time we were ever disappointed, the first time we were ever burnt. From then on in our life, every time that happens, it's kind of like a trigger to that very first time that you felt that.
I just think it's so interesting listening to your story. Like, I think that you come across to me as very strong, and I think you are very strong. But where does that strength come from?
I think it's a resilience. I think it does come from hardships. I don't think that people are necessarily born with that resilience.
But you literally take off the bandage and show people your scars in some way.
Yeah.
And I think that that is incredibly brave.
Yeah, it's hard. I do become numb to it sometimes. Like I definitely give presentations. Like when I first started presenting, it was like so deeply re-traumatizing, and writing the book was re-traumatizing because it was like going back into my childhood and putting everything I've ever experienced onto the page for others to read and potentially judge. And it's also like, God, it's so hard writing about things that you don't want to remember, like that you would rather forget. And so there was a lot of red wine involved in my writing process. It was kind of the only way I could get through.
That's where your love of red wine came from?
Yes. And so, yeah, it was really difficult. And so getting up then and speaking about my life and all of these scars that there is a big part of me that just wants to walk away from and be like, no, I'm done with all of this. But the reality is that like I didn't have the support that I needed growing up. I didn't have a mentor or a role model that I needed growing up. And I know that now with the level of privilege and the platforms that I have, I can be that for someone else. So my goal has always been to be the person that I never had growing up.
Is that
that's why I do it.
Is that where writing comes from? Is that what made you want to be a writer? Is that you wanted to share that story?
Yeah, and I wanted to create a resource that kids could pass on to their parents instead of having to do all of that work and all of that education that I had to do. That now they can actually be like, you know what, why don't you just read this book and then we can talk about it afterwards. And that is so powerful, and I've had so many messages and conversations with young people and old people and people of all backgrounds about the book and how it's functioned in that way. But I also think, you know, being a queer person or being a part of a marginalized identity, like, we don't get represented very often, and sometimes we have to write ourselves into existence.
So true. It must be hard to sort of pull that story out of you.
Yeah, and to find words for things that there just are no words. That's difficult. And yeah, but I do see myself like writing more books and writing more short stories and maybe writing children's books. And, you know, like, I definitely think that is where my future is going as well.
Were you worried as you were writing it that you were going to be accurate about the story?
So worried.
I can imagine, because I know for myself, I would feel so much pressure on telling a story that was accurate, because
totally.
I would be worried about who was reading it and how I would help them.
Yeah, and I mean, even in the moment, it was less even about who was reading it, and it was more about being truthful to myself. There was a lot of research that went into it. Like, it wasn't just like I sat down with my red wine and I just went, blah, 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 like, this is my life. I, like, went back to old diaries. I went, luckily, you know, I'm a young person, so I had Facebook my entire life, pretty much. So I went back to Facebook. I, like, very much did this, like, immersive experience where I put myself back into that person. I mean, I'm an empath, so, like, I very much can feel other people's feelings. So I would take 13-year-old me, I would look at photos of myself, I would look at statuses I wrote, I would look at writings and poems and songs and whatever, and I would put myself back into that person so that I could write from that person rather than from me as an older retrospective. And that was terrifying and awful, because I was so full of pain in those times in my life, and to have to put myself back through that, it was re-traumatizing.
It's like reliving the idea of depression.
It was exactly that.
It was reliving the idea of suicide.
Yep.
It was reliving a pain that was incredibly difficult.
It was reliving every hardship I had ever been through. But it was the only way that I was going to tell that story authentically.
Do you think that you were talking to yourself, or you were talking to a specific person, or were you talking to the community?
All of the above.
So you didn't sit there with your glass of red wine and feel like, this is a certain person that I'm talking to. It was a collective.
I mean, I did feel like my main person that I cared about was, you know, I can't actually go back and speak to me at 16 or 17 when I first came out as trans and say, it's going to be okay, or you're not the only one. And so that was my primary demographic, was I need this book to be what I didn't have. So I was definitely thinking about that kid who is feeling so alone, who doesn't know how to explain what they're going through, who can't see a future for themselves, who feels like the lights have just been turned out and everything is miserable and there's no hope. That was the kid that I was primarily writing to.
What do you reckon is the career highlights for you thus far as a 22-year-old? You had an impact with Safe Schools.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty impressive. Your work with the documentary I thought was impressive. You've got a book, which we've just been talking about. Or would you say maybe working with queer kids and their parents? Is there something of a career highlight to you?
Definitely. There are lots. I think one was going on the morning show on Channel 7 with my mum. And I sort of forced the producer to change the script and to send me the script before the segment. And she said, we never do this. Like, we never send the scripts to the talent, but we don't want to get it wrong. And I rewrote the whole thing and gave it back to her. And she was, like, super respectful and really excited about it. And then I went on national television for the first time, like, with my mom. And they used they pronouns. And all the language was perfect, and it was the most, like, revolutionary moment for me. And I think it was a huge moment for the trans community to have very mainstream, often problematic television saying all the right things and asking all the right questions. And I remember at that point I was feeling very much like an imposter. Like, what am I doing? I just got this book deal because I'm trans and I'm not actually talented and I'm not actually a good writer, and, you know, why is this happening, and I'm just so privileged. And then I remember Larry Emder, at the end of the morning show, after we'd filmed, looked at me and he said to me, with no prompting, he said to me, you know, a lot of people have interesting stories, but it's the way that you tell it. And that just, like, filled my body with shivers. I was just like, okay, yeah, cool. All right. I feel really valid and I feel really seen.
I love that you have this, because in any dark times, and we all have them, and you will have them, you can look back, and I think that's going to give you power.
Yeah. And I mean, that moment was amazing. And then that's not even taking into account the countless messages and conversations I've had with young trans people or bisexual people or whatever that have messaged me and be like, after you came to my school, I came out. Or I have been so suicidal, and seeing you just, like, completely showed me a light. or, you know, I mean, I've been the first person some people have come out to as trans. Like, those moments are priceless. I had always said that if this book makes one person's life better, then my job is done. And I have, like, a list. I have, like, a countless list of people whose lives have been improved.
You were talking about the fact that you are going to write books and moving away from memoirs. What other stories are you looking forward to telling?
I really want to tell more stories where there are diverse and queer characters, but it's not necessarily focused on their gender and their sexuality. I really want to represent that we have, like, strong lives outside of that. I also really want to create some, like, problematic queer characters. I feel like we don't have the option to be crappy because there's only one of us in the media. You know, like, when you've got a panel with, like, one trans person, that one trans person can't be crappy because then they represent the entire trans community.
You want flawed people.
Yeah, like, if I had a book with, like, five trans characters, I could have one who is, like, violent and abusive. I could have one who's creative, and, you know, like, I could have lots of diversity in that. And I want to have problematic queer characters. I want to show that we exist. Well, not we, they exist. I don't want to coin myself as a problematic. Well, I am problematic.
But that's what's good about you, is that I also think that's what brings people to your story, is that you do make mistakes and you talk about that.
Totally. Yeah.
And I think for people out there that are trying to present themselves as a hero, sometimes they're not, because they're trying to present themselves as the squeaky clean image, where I think the best people and the ones that I'm really drawn to are people who are human.
Yeah, well, exactly. And so, like, I want to write more stories with characters like that, with characters whose actions are questionable, whose ideologies are questionable. I want more representation of strong, queer, platonic friendships that aren't just about, you know, hypersexuality or that kind of thing.
You know, Australia's been on a journey, and we are on that journey. I shouldn't say that it's coming to an end, because there'll always be a story here. But how do you feel looking back at Australia's relationship with the LGBTI community?
Oh, just looking back on anything of Australia's, I just feel deeply embarrassed and ashamed. I think that we do such a bad job at so many things. I think we do a great job at a lot of things, but I think our refugee policies, the way that we treat our Indigenous peoples, like our relationship to the LGBTI community, to try and see Tony Abbott take credit for gay marriage now, like, I think it's disgusting. I think the fact that we had a vote in 2017 or whatever is, like, disgusting and embarrassing. It was some of the worst times for so many people. The mental health completely plummeted. The access to mental health services of young people went up 40%. Like, I'm not proud. I'm not proud to be an Australian at this point in my life. No.
And I think when we look back, I think people will forget that this all happened at this time.
Yeah, I think that we really do have a selective memory. I think that we remember what we want to remember. I think that we don't talk about colonization as an ongoing event. Like, it's not just a one-off event. I don't think that we talk about how Aboriginal children are being taken from their families at higher rates than the stolen generation. I don't think that we want to talk about the LGBTIQA people on Manus Island who don't care about gay marriage. They're just, like, suffering and are imprisoned for absolutely no reason. Like, they have committed no crimes. They are treated with no level of justice. I don't think that we want to think about those things. I think we are very selective with our history, and I think our history is mostly painted white and is mostly full of lies.
And what do you think we need to change? What do you think needs to be put under the magnifying glass?
I think that we really need to think a lot about the ways in which we treat the true custodians of the land. I think that we need to start paying our rent back to actual elders and giving them their land rights back and creating a treaty. I think that we need to listen to them and not lead those campaigns, but rather step behind and be quiet and let them lead for once, you know, as in, obviously, they've been running their own activism for 80,000 years. But I think we need to, you know, put down the white savior complex and step back and just listen. And I think we need to open our borders to refugees in a much more welcoming and loving way, because if that's what we think Australia is like loving and a land of opportunity and multiculturalism, then we need to actually show that.
You know what, Nev, I honestly feel as though it's interesting to ask you that question, because I've just done 16 episodes of this series and I've asked different people different questions about what needs to be put under the magnifying glass, and everyone said, we need to treat the trans community better than we have. Nearly everyone. You know, and when people are saying this, it doesn't come across like they exactly know what we need to do. So I'll ask you that question. You know, what is it that we need to do when we put under the magnifying glass the LGBTI community? What is it that we need to do for trans people?
I think, firstly, we need to shake our beliefs a little bit to the core. I think that we need to remember that our LGBTIQA community didn't start from assimilation. It started from radicalism and from overthrowing systems and from rage and from oppression and from harsh laws and murder and, you know, passion. I think we need to find that again. I think if you're comfortable and you feel safe in your life, then it's probably because you have a lot of privilege, and then you need to think about all of the others who don't. I mean, our queer rights was started by trans women of colour, and they are still the ones that are murdered at the highest rates, that commit suicide at the highest rates, that have the least rights. I think we really need to ask ourselves how we can best support them, and I think the best way to support them is also by, like, including them in that conversation and asking them specifically. And, you know, I don't think that it's easy. I don't think that it's like you should do this and you should do that, but I think you should get out of your comfort zone, and I think you should remember that for as long as some people aren't free, none of us are.
Today is International Transgender Day of Visibility, and what does that really mean for you?
I think it's a day of mourning. I mean, even though, you know, we also have Transgender Day of Remembrance, Transgender Day of Visibility is still a day of mourning. I think about the people who don't get to be visible, who actually, to be visible would mean to be harassed or to be hurt or injured or killed or, you know, spat on. I think about the people who have to hide their transness in order to get jobs and houses and custody and whatever. That's what I'm thinking about on this day.
And I think it's about inclusion as well. I think that when I thought about this and when I listened to your story and when I listened to what other people's interpretation of all of this is that I think transgender people need to be included more in decision-making that happens.
Yeah. And right, not just included, but centred. I don't think that we should be asked for our labour for free. I don't think that we should be asked to come on board as some sort of liaison or whatever to teach an organization how to be more trans inclusive. I think that our work and our emotional labor needs to be valued. I think that we need to be on more boards and more councils and more, you know, like if you want your organization or your business to be more trans inclusive, don't just get a trans person to come in and speak. Hire trans people. Get trans people higher up in the ranks of your business.
If people out there listening to this right now want to be serious about their inclusion of transgender people, then they need to pay for what they're getting.
Totally. And you can totally book me to come in and do it.
Do you know what? There's a sub question to this, you know, because you're such an attractive person. Do you reckon that that's a part of the reason why it's almost like it's more digestive to listen to all of this from you?
Definitely.
Because you are such an attractive person. I mean, you speak so well and you look lovely. I'm giving you the compliment, but do you reckon that that means that people are accessing you in a different way to than
totally
what they may be doing for uncomfortably looking at trans people?
Yes. Yes. I think the fact that I am trans masculine, that I am cis passing, that I look like a man, that I'm relatively masculine and I'm not like super femme. I think when I like dress down and I don't dress super queer, I think because I speak with conviction, because I'm eloquent, because I'm well educated, all of those things are huge privileges and are the reason why people actually listen to me, which is a huge shame and is awful. But at the same time, I'm trying to use those privileges in the best ways that I can to direct them to or be a bridging kind of person for the rest of the community. I mean, in my book, like the end of the book, I have a further reading list, which is like mostly trans women of color and, you know, a very diverse kind of list. Because I think that's where people need to go.
Away from that, sort of breaking it down, because we do get to feel so comfortable about this conversation, I can directly ask you this. Mm-hmm. Is there something that I do as an individual? What can I do on my day-to-day life to be more inclusive to the trans community?
I think firstly, you know, not making assumptions about people's gender. I think when you meet someone and you're not sure, like introducing yourself and saying your pronouns, saying like,
how am I going so far?
Yeah, you're good. You're doing well. But, you know, saying like, hi, I'm Nev. My pronouns are they, them. What about yourself? And even if your pronouns are like he, him, and you've presented as a man your whole life, it's still a way of kind of neutralizing that territory, not to be like, oh, you look weird, what are you? You know, just being like, oh, hey, nice to meet you, I use he, him pronouns, what about you? That's a really easy thing you can do. Not using gender-exclusive language like boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen. You could just say like, hey, everyone, hey, friends, hey, peers, hey, coworkers, hey, gang, if you want to be one of those cool people. You know, or you could be a little bit more political. You could say, hey, boys, girls, and everyone in between, or who's not sure. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, and all the other gender identities. You know, like you could kind of like mess with that a little bit. You can not make assumptions about what's in someone's pants based off what they might look like. You know, not making comments where you conflate penises with manhood or periods with womanhood or those kind of things, I think is a really great way. And I think just reading more and getting educated so it becomes part of your vernacular and it doesn't feel like such work all the time.
Do you have a specific message for the queer community that are listening to this right now?
This world wasn't necessarily built for us in the way that it functions, and I think we do a bloody good job of carving our own space out.
And cultivating it, yeah. And I guess it's important for you and for people like us to share our stories.
Yeah. I think my goal at the end of the day, and this is what I always say in my speeches, is that regardless of politics, regardless of labels, regardless of lifestyles, whatever, my goal in life is to be the kindest, best person I can be, and that is constantly what I am trying to do, and I'm always prying and prodding at my ideology from all different sides to try and find what is the right thing to be. And I think as long as we're all asking ourselves that all the time, like, are you acting out of love or are you acting out of ego, I think when we ask ourselves those questions, we can really create community spaces that are abundant in their love and unconditional in their support.
Well, as you said, and I think it's very true, I think you're very eloquent in the way that you put things together, and it's been amazing to sit down here today on International Transgender Day of Visibility.
Thank you for having me.
And have this story. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.